Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Shri Prabhupada, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation. When they quarrel among themselves, influenced by intoxication, with their eyes red like copper because of drinking madhu, then only will they disappear. Otherwise, it will not be possible. On my disappearance, this incident will take place. Purport. The Lord and His associates appear and disappear by the will of the Lord. They're not subjected to the laws of material nature. No one was able to kill the family of the Lord, nor was there any possibility of their natural death by the laws of nature. The only means, therefore, for their disappearance was the make-show of a fight amongst themselves, as if brawling in intoxication due to drinking. That so-called fighting would also take place by the will of the Lord. Otherwise, there would be no cause for their fighting. Just as Arjuna was made to be illusioned by family affection, and thus the Bhagavad Gita was spoken, so the Yadu dynasty was made to be intoxicated by the will of the Lord, and nothing more. The devotees and associates of the Lord are completely surrendered souls. Thus, they are transcendental instruments in the hands of the Lord and can be used in any way the Lord desires. The pure devotees also enjoy such pastimes of the Lord because they want to see Him happy. Devotees of the Lord never assert independent individuality. On the contrary, they utilize their individuality in pursuit of the desires of the Lord. And this cooperation of the devotees with the Lord makes a perfect scene of the Lord's pastimes. Recite the Mangalacharan. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamascha Shri Rupam Sagarjatam Sahaganaragunatanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadhavetam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamascha He Krishna Kuruna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpatrubhyascha Kripa Sindhyubhyascha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nitti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jai. Thank you everybody for joining us, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to the devotees who are involved. And I seek the blessings of all the Vaishnavas. Seeking blessings for this class, there are a couple of things that really stood out for me. So I'd like to just remind myself of the blessings that I've been received. So one is to speak something which is bona fide, something which I speak which is purifying for myself as well as for others. Something which is according to my own realizations and not more. And also one which I remember that this service of sitting on the Vyasasana to give class is a service to the devotees and the Vaishnavas. So I seek your blessings that I may remember these blessings that have been received and act in accordance to that. So thank you for turning the volume up. But yeah. So I think it would be nice to just summarize where we've got to in terms of the canto, right? So we're in Canto 3, Chapter 3. So the canto starts with actually Vidura going on pilgrimage, right, after brief discussions happening at the end of Canto 2. And at the end of Chapter 1 of Canto 3, Vidura meets Uddhava. Uddhava is Krishna's cousin and friend and quite dear associate. And they start having some discussions, and as part of the discussions at the end of chapter 1, we see that Vidura is inquiring. He's asking many, many questions, specifically about Krishna, Krishna's family, the Pandavas, and what they're up to. And at this point, Vidura already knew to some degree that they had left the planet. And then in chapter 2, we see that Uddhava replies back, and he's in ecstasy at the questions that were asked. And out of that ecstasy, what does he do? He starts glorifying the Supreme Lord. And specifically, he glorifies those pastimes which pain his heart. And this pain is actually a glorious pain, because it reminds Uddhava of how much love and affection the Lord has for his devotees. Whereas our pain, it's like, you know, it pricks, so we like don't want any involvement with it. And as part of that ecstasy, Uddhava starts also then talking at the end of chapter 2 about the pastimes of the Lord in Vrindavan. And then in chapter 3, he starts talking about the pastimes of the Lord outside of Vrindavan, which is where we are, right, in terms of pastimes. So the chapter itself is called The Lord's Pastimes Out of Vrindavan, chapter 3. And we see that a lot of these pastimes that are being discussed are basically like teasers, like trailers to the movie that's going to come in Canto 10 and beyond. You know, they're just snippets. They're just one-liners of all the pastimes that are about to come. So in one way, Uddhava is whetting our appetite for the pastimes to come, for the future cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then yesterday, Srinivas Prabhu gave a very nice class on verse 14, which is about the burden of the beast versus the burden of love. How the earth is burdened so much by all these, you know, atrocities that are taking place. And how the Lord is thinking about how to alleviate these atrocities. How to alleviate Mother Earth from all this burden. And then this verse, verse 15, which I'll read out. When they quarrel among themselves, influenced by intoxication, with the eyes red like copper because of drinking madhu, then only will they disappear. Otherwise, it will not be possible. On my disappearance, this incident will take place. So in this verse, we see how the Lord has actually given his practical solution of how he wants to alleviate the burden of the earth. And how is that? By using his own associates, his own devotees, to fight with each other, to kill each other. Or as Prabhupada says in the purport, to make show of a fight amongst themselves. And this is interesting because it's a very beautiful example of how the Lord uses his devotees according to his will. Right? And we can see that the Lord, I mean, it's described, transcendental instruments, right? They are transcendental instruments in the hands of the Lord. How the Lord is actually using his devotees as instruments to carry out his will. And to some degree, we're all actually instruments. Right? Because what does an instrument actually mean? It means a tool that is used for a specific purpose. Like if we take a clock or a watch, it's a tool to measure the passing of time. If we take this mic, it's a tool to broadcast, a tool to amplify sound. If we take our phones, I mean, it's a multi-purpose tool, but at the core of it, it's a tool for communication, for connection. Right? Like this, we can look around and there's some tools. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna that this body is a tool. He says, Sarva Bhutani Yantarudhani Mayaya. He says that all the living entities, all the living beings are yantra rudani, seated on a machine. This body is calling a machine, mayaya, which is made of material energy. So he's calling the body a yantra, a machine, a vehicle to help us go from point A to point B. And what is that instrument for? It's to fulfill our desires, right? The desires that we have, which are sanctioned by the super soul. So the body is a machine. And if we look all around us, we can see that practically everything is an instrument of some sort. Everything has a purpose. And actually, even the spirit soul, even us, we're also instruments. Because we know, Prabhupada says, that the constitutional position of the living entity of the soul is of service. So the soul is practically an instrument of service. But the question is, whose instrument of service are we? Are we instrument of service of Maya, or are we instrument of service to Krishna? What does it mean to be an instrument of service to Maya? Well, ultimately we understand that it's about gratifying the senses. It's about serving the senses. That's what basically being an instrument of Maya means. We're serving the senses. And what do the senses demand? Well, I'd like to think that the senses have like a superiority complex. They want to lord over everything and anything, right? If you think, if you were walking down the street and you heard a very nice melody, a very nice tune, a very nice song, then immediately the eyes are going to go, let me try and find where it's coming from. If we see a nice flower in the park, immediately the nose is thinking, let me go smell it. If we smell, and it's not time yet, but if we smell food, nice food, whether or not it's prasadam, the taste, the tongue is going to go, let me go and taste it. The senses just want to enjoy. The senses just want to, you know, lord it over. They just want to be the master. And like this, we can see in the world that most of the people are influenced by this material energy of the Lord, the external energy of the Lord, just have this mood of becoming the master. And everything they try is to gratify the senses and be the master. People think that, okay, I've got a big house, I've got a big car, I've got a big bank balance, I've got a big family, I've got a big position at work, I've become a master. But the reality is that even when a CEO, even when the prime minister goes home at the end of a long day of work, he's just the servant of his wife, of his children, of his pet. And actually, even at work, they're actually servants. Because for government, anything in a government position, we say they're public servants. This idea of service is already there. Even for a CEO, like recently, just last month, our CEO swapped at the company. So when the old CEO left, everybody got an email to say that Mr. So-and-so has decided to end his service with our company. And when the new CEO joined, he was saying, again, email goes around, and as part of his inspiration, as part of his initial speech that he was writing, he was saying, I'm happy to be of service and support you where I can. So this idea of even being a master, it's recognized that even in, at least in language, that everybody's still a servant. Again, the question is, are we a servant of Maya or are we a servant of Krishna? But we see that this is basically what material life is. It's about cultivating this mentality that I'm a master. But in reality, it's just about being the servant of our senses and thus an instrument of Maya. That's material life in a nutshell. We think that we're becoming the master, but we're actually just becoming more and more of a servant to our senses and thus an instrument of Maya. On the other hand, spiritual life is about cultivating this mood or transforming our consciousness from being a godas, which is a servant of the senses, to being a goswami, which is a master of the senses. And that's the beginning of our spiritual life. In the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, Sri Rupa Goswami gives a very nice verse, which is summarized in the Nectar of Devotion by Sri Prabhupada. Sarva padevi nirmuktam tatparatvena nirmalam rishikena rishikesha sevanam bhakti ruchyate. He's saying that bhakti or devotional service, this idea of spiritual life, is about engaging ourselves in the service, engaging all of our senses in the service of the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, who is Rishikesha, the master of the senses. And he describes that there's two things that happens from that. One is that our senses become purified because they're being engaged in the master of the senses. And the second is that this consciousness, this mentality of lording over material nature also gets cleansed. So just by engaging in the Lord's service, just by pleasing Krishna, our spiritual life, our ability to overcome this, or the desires of the senses, starts off. And actually, devotional service is the bread and butter of spiritual life. Why? Because when we engage in devotional service, then we're forced to actually realize that even in a minute way, we're not the doer, we're just an instrument of Krishna. And even in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, Nimitra matram bhavastavya sachin. He's telling Arjuna, Nimitra matram, just become my instrument. O savya sachin. Right? This savya sachin means expert shooter of arrows. So he's telling Arjuna, become my instrument. How? By using your God-given abilities, your God-given gifts and talents and skills in my service, in God's service, the way Krishna desires. We can say that we're just like a pen, actually, right? I mean, I'm sure some people have notebooks. Yeah, I see a notebook in Karan's hand and a pen. We're just like a pen. Now, on its own, if you just have a pen, pretty useless, right? Does nothing. But imagine if a child or a illiterate person picks a pen up. Then what happens? Pen gets utilized, but I mean, no offense to the parents or, you know, the children, but I mean, it's not the best use of the pen, you know? I mean, something comes out of it, but nothing, you know, amazing that people will be like, wow, that's amazing. But imagine the pen gets picked up by the world's best-selling author. Then we know something amazing is about to come out, right? The pen is going to twirl and dance on the paper, and something creative, something inspiring, something amazing is going to come out of that work. And we can take that and see that if we're the pen, if we're not engaged in anything, then nothing's going to come of it. If we're engaged in Maya, which is akin to a child or an illiterate person who doesn't know how to use a pen, then, I mean, something comes out, but it's not very optimal use of the pen. But if the pen is used by Krishna, I mean, we know he's the world's best-selling author, then something amazing can come from us. And that's the idea, becoming an instrument in Krishna's hands, dancing to the tune that Krishna is playing. And maybe if somebody has it on their phone, then maybe at the end, if we have time, we could go through the poem that Śrīla Prabhupāda wrote on the Jaladuta about being that instrument of Krishna, about being the puppet of Krishna. And even when we look at CC in Madhya Lila, I think it's chapter 7, Mahaprabhu's journey to South India, is that chapter 7, I think? 7 or 8. Then even there we see, actually it's very interesting because Mahaprabhu, when he was traveling to South India, anybody he would meet, he would say, Hari, Hari. Exactly. They would just go, Hari, Hari. And in response, you know, he may get a Hari, Hari back or not. But he, just by Mahaprabhu's call out of Hari, Hari to all the people, by embracing all the people he met, it's described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that all these people, their spiritual life really began. They were enthused, they were inspired in their spiritual life. They were injected with spiritual potency. And they were empowered in their devotional service. And what happened is that when these people, who now became devotees, they went to their own villages, they made the whole village into devotees. These people who Mahaprabhu had just met became so empowered that they empowered others to become devotees. And it doesn't just end there. What happens when they went to other villages? they also were so empowered that they made devotees in other villages. And thus, the first bhakti riksha was manifest, basically. This idea that from devotees comes more devotees, comes more devotees. Because that's the empowerment that Mahaprabhu was given. Oftentimes we can look around us and think, okay, that these swamis, these great senior Vaishnavas, they're so empowered. They're so amazing devotees that they're able to make devotees. But Mahaprabhu in this pastime is showing that actually he's empowered every single devotee who is engaged in the Sankirtan mission, engaged in Mahaprabhu's mission, is empowered. Their service is empowered. But not only that, in ISKCON, we have the added mercy of Prabhupada. It's Prabhupada's mercy that in, I don't know whether to call it a gloomy day or a sunny day just yet, but in a gloomy day in Watford, we have a nice, beautiful piece of land on Dharmak. And in that nice piece of land, we have a nice, beautiful cottage called the Bhaktivedanta Manor. And within that Bhaktivedanta Manor, we have a nice temple room where Shishi Radha Gokulananda, Shishi Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman, and Shishi Gornitai eternally reside. And we get to have Bhagavad Gata or Krishna Katha every single day. Now we can think, okay, this is Prabhupada's mercy that came to us and now we're utilizing it. But no, the reality is, this mercy is an everyday thing. When we have our Kantimala, that's also a form of mercy. When we're wearing tilak, that's also a form of mercy. When we've got our bead bag, our chanting beads, that's also a form of mercy. And all this is enabled by the mercy of Prabhupada. It's an everyday subject that we're coming in contact with mercy. And this parampara of mercy is our empowerment to spread the compassionate nature of the Lord in our services. We could say that this mercy that we receive on a day-to-day basis, or that is surrounding us, is actually a hidden form of empowerment in our services. But the problem is that oftentimes, more often than not actually, is our own false ego that comes in the way of unlocking that mercy. So if we want to realize Krishna's empowerment that he's given all around us, then we have to tap into the mercy that we've actually received. And this idea of being an empowered instrument through mercy is actually an interesting phenomenon, right? I mean, I didn't recite it today, but oftentimes you hear devotees, just before they're about to speak, they recite a very nice verse which is found in CC, but I think it comes from one of the other scriptures as well. Mukam karati vachalam pangum langayate girim yat kripatam aham vande shi gurum dinataranam. Mukam karati vachalam, this idea that somebody who is dumb, somebody who can't speak, is empowered or is able to recite nice poetry, to create nice creative songs. Pangum langayate girim. This idea that a lame man, somebody who can't even walk two steps without support, is able to cross mountains. Yat kripatam aham vande shi gurum dinataranam. All this is possible by the mercy of Guru, by the mercy of the compassionate, all-merciful Guru. By the mercy of Guru, we can actually do things beyond what we think we're capable of doing. This mercy of Guru empowers us to serve in a capacity that is beyond the limitations of our own material situations. And that's the mercy. As Srila Prabhupada says in this purport as well, right? Quote, the devotees and associates of the Lord are completely surrendered souls. Thus, they are transcendental instruments in the hands of the Lord and can be used in any way the Lord desires. Unquote. This idea that through being completely surrendered, the Lord empowers us and uses us in any which way, shape, or form He desires. The Lord isn't thinking about, oh, you know, Shishi Radha Goklananda, Shishi Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman, Shishi Gornitaya Ki Jai. The Lord is not thinking that this devotee, he's not able to walk. He's not thinking this devotee, he's a female. Oh, sorry, she's a female or a male. Not thinking that, oh, this devotee is a brahmachari, a grihastha, a sannyasi. The Lord is just thinking, this devotee is a surrendered soul, and I'm just going to empower him and make him a tool, an instrument in the way that I want to use him. So the Lord isn't considering our material situation. He's not considering the body we're in. He's not considering the ashram we're in. All the Lord is thinking about is, this person is surrendered. I can use him in whichever way, shape, or form I want. And we see in this verse, in this pastime, that that Krishna's family members are described as being totally surrendered. And so the Lord used them to kill each other in order to relieve the burden of the earth. And what is this surrender that I'm speaking about, right? Surrender means that we actually stop thinking about what we want and think about what Krishna wants. We put Krishna's desires above and beyond our desires. Krishna's instructions, Krishna's direction comes first, and our desired direction is secondary. But surrender isn't something that we do just once. Right? It's not that we wake up one day and go, okay, Krishna, I'm yours. Then we decide, okay, we're going to pack our bags, we're going to leave the country, we're going to become a brahmachari or brahmacharini in the temple, and then go in front of the deities and go, finally, I'm yours now. You know, I'm surrendered unto you, Krishna. Because the reality is that we could be even living in the temple for many, many weeks, for many, many months, for many, many years, and not actually have surrendered. And that's the reality. If it was so easy to become surrendered unto Krishna that you just join the temple, then I think we'd probably not have any congregation of devotees, right? Because everybody like, I'm just going to join the temple, and that's it, I'm surrendered. That's my life done. Surrender is something that we have to do from moment to moment. Each moment, we have to consciously decide to pick Krishna over ourselves. Each moment, we have to think, Krishna's desire comes before my desire. Each moment, we have to go, Krishna's direction is more than my direction. From moment to moment, every moment, we have to consciously decide that this moment I'm going to surrender. This moment I'm going to surrender. This moment I'm choosing Krishna. This moment I'm choosing Krishna. And this moment. But oftentimes we're faced up with a block, right? Our own false ego comes in the way. We've developed mental shortcuts for quick decisions and overnight successes. We're hoping that Krishna consciousness, this idea of surrender, will happen just overnight. But the reality and the truth of the matter is that if we really want serious, real, long-term spiritual progress, then there's no alternative to discipline, determination, and diligent endeavor. This idea that it's a journey that we have to take with commitment. Right? This journey that we have to take with consistency, day in, day out, we have to try and practice it. And we have to make serious endeavor to make it happen. If we really want to become empowered instruments in the hands of the Lord, then that commitment, that consistency, that sincere endeavor is required. In fact, it's mandatory for us. Because there's no other alternative. Krishna's not going to just come in our dream one day and go, okay, you know, I know you're not really doing much for me, but today I'm going to inspire you, I'm going to enlighten you to become the great Vaishnava. So what is this idea of sincere endeavor, right? Many devotees may have this false notion that sincere endeavor is about just engaging in lots and lots of service. There's a new project coming up. Great, let's get involved in it. Get involved in all the projects that are out there. This idea that we have to fill our diaries with service. I mean, we should do that as much as we can because that helps purify us. But is that really what sincere endeavor is about? That we just get engaged in every and any service that comes our way? The reality is, and this is an unfortunate reality, that we can speak to many devotees who are engaged like that for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and they'll almost feel like they haven't really made much advancement. Of course, the process of service is so purifying, is so amazing that everybody who is engaged in service will make some advancement. But is that really the most optimal way for us to make advancement? Just fill our diaries with service. It doesn't matter what else is going on. Just fill our diary with service. For optimal results, we need to learn how to apply that process of endeavoring in service properly. This kripa shakti, this empowerment through mercy, comes when whatever service we're doing, it could be big or small, whatever the service is, but we do it to the best possible capacity we have in the mood that we really want to please Krishna and the Vaishnavas. We don't want to just be engaged in external services. We want to cultivate that internal consciousness that whatever we're doing is for the pleasure of Guru, Gauranga, Krishna, the devotees and Vaishnavas. Sincere endeavor, we could say, is like a heartfelt endeavor, where we're putting our heart into what we're doing. We're actually giving ourselves to the service, whatever the service we're doing. And it could be literally any service. It could be building a temple. It could be book distribution. It could be pujari service. It could be engaging in cooking bhoga for the deities. It could be organizing events, doing administration stuff. The question isn't how many services are we getting engaged in. The question is, are we giving ourselves fully to the services we are engaged in? Is our heart there? Is our mood of serving Krishna there? Because, I mean, we all can speak openly about this, but we all would have gone through or heard or seen many, many different moods in service. One mood is, yeah, okay, I've got this service coming up. Just go with the flow. This BAU, as we call it, this business as usual service. Yep, okay, class ends. Okay, I need to clean the temple room. Go into the cupboard, get the mop out, get everything out. Come, sweep. Okay, that's it, service done. Next service. We could have that mood. Another type of mood could be that, okay, this service, I've been doing it for so long. I'm not really inspired to do it. The people around me, not really inspiring. But you know what? Guru's told me that I need to do this service, so I'll just do it anyway. But I'll do it in a way that, you know, I don't take so much responsibility, I don't do so much. And then 6 months, 9 months, 12 months down the line, I'll be, Guru Maharaj, you know, you told me to do this service, I'm doing it, it's not inspiring, I'm not really getting anywhere, so I'll do something else. That's another way to serve. Or another mood to serve could be, you know what? Okay, my service is to just clean the temple room. But the temple room, the Vaishnavas come, the Lord stay in the temple room. I want to do it in a way that will actually please Krishna and the Guru and the Vaishnavas. And in that way, we're enthusiastically serving with that commitment to the service. Now, I don't think I need to tell you guys which of these is like the best mood to have to attract the mercy and the empowerment. But we can see that heartfelt endeavor means so much more in our own advancement in spiritual life. And naturally what happens when we have that heartfelt endeavor, that heartfelt enthusiasm, is that not only do we do the service at hand, but we start thinking, how can I improve in my service? We start wanting to do the service in our best possible way. We start growing in our own service. And then what happens? We start thinking, how can the service be done better? How can we improve the service itself? How can we develop the service? And then how can this one service I'm doing, how can we expand that to impact others? And then naturally, with that sort of consciousness, what comes? Responsibility in the service. We start to take responsibility in the services that we're doing. And when we take responsibility in our service to Krishna, that's where real empowerment, that's where the real mercy comes. Because when we take responsibility in Krishna's service, we're forced to surrender to Krishna. We're forced to take shelter of Guru, Gauranga and Krishna and the Vaishnavas. Because when we're taking responsibility, now we're starting to act, now we're starting to think of, how can I serve in a way which is beyond my capacity, beyond my own comfort zone? And naturally, if we're beyond our comfort zone, then it's like we want support in place. And the prime support for a Vaishnava is the shelter they've taken from the mercy of the parampara. So actually, sincere endeavor, right, is meant to revolve around this mood that we're not just doing a service. We're actually taking responsibility which forces us to take shelter of Guru and Krishna. And actually, that's what endeavor and service is about. It's not about just getting the task done. Krishna doesn't need the task to be done. If Krishna wanted, he could keep the temple clean all his life, you know, all of our life. He doesn't need us to come and clean the temple room. So if our endeavor is in just cleaning the temple room, then okay, we're engaging in service, but it's not the optimal thing. Because we actually want to cultivate that inner, internal consciousness that what I'm doing is for Krishna. What I'm doing is for the Vaishnavas. Krishna doesn't need our service, we need the service. And oftentimes we just take advantage that, okay, you know, so much service is coming my way. Prabhu, you know, this service is too small for me. And we want to move on. We want to do bigger things. And we see this mood of sincere endeavor, we see in the life of Srila Prabhupada. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave Srila Prabhupada the instruction, go all around the world multiple times and set up 108 temples. No. All Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur told Prabhupada was to go to the West and preach. Now, Srila Prabhupada could have just gone to the West, given one or two classes, and then come back and said, tick in the box, you know, Guru's instruction, tick, I've done Guru's service. But he didn't. He took that instruction from Guru and really meditated on it. He really gave it all his energy, all his endeavor to think, okay, Guru Maharaj has given this instruction, but how can I make it, how can I expand that service? How can I really endeavor in that service to make it not just a good offering to Krishna, but the best offering to Krishna? He didn't come up with 20, 30, 40 different services and go, okay, you know, I'm serving Guru. He went, this is my service. I've been designated this service, whatever it is for us, school of bhakti, book distribution, whatever it is, you know, BMF, whatever. If Guru has given us, serve this project, serve this in this capacity, it is up to us to actually take that instruction and just do a tick in the box. Yes, I'm serving in this way. I'm serving this project. Or to actually go, okay, the heart of the Guru is in making that so successful. So let me give my life and soul. And we saw Prabhupada was empowered to do that. Because moment to moment, he was thinking about and meditating on his Guru and the instruction of his Guru, not just to fulfill the instruction, but to expand that instruction in the best possible way. And thus we have so many temples around the world and so many temples being developed around the world in the name of A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And so, you know, this forms a very interesting point of comparison for us, because we can look around and go, all these devotees, all these senior Vaishnavas, this Swami, that Swami, they're empowered, they're going around the world, they're creating devotees. But I'm not empowered to do that. But this is the interesting point of comparison. Look at what they're doing, but look at why they're achieving what they're achieving. And that why is because their endeavor is not to tick in the box service. Their endeavor is to go, this is the service, how can I expand it? How can I actually take shelter and serve in that mood of servitude? Yes, we should look at all these great Vaishnavas and appreciate that they're doing so much, that they're empowered with all this mercy. But let's also follow in their footsteps and expand our own responsibilities in the services we've had, so that we can come to the point that we're taking shelter and we're surrendering to the process, to the service, to Guru and Gauranga. And then we'll see that that empowerment that we have all received through mercy becomes unlocked. Because now, instead of putting our false ego in the way that we're nobody great, we're not a sannyasi, we're not very learned, we're actually going, the process is not about gyan or karma. The process is about surrendering to Krishna. And that surrender is an internal consciousness. So let's follow in those footsteps and actually cultivate that internal surrender. And then expand and enhance the services we're doing. Give all our energy and endeavor in the service, external and internal, so that we can unlock that empowerment. And as the Vaishnavas in this verse, become transcendental instruments in the hands of the Lord. Surrender. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Any comments, questions, corrections? Priyojan Prabhu, Mike?
What you were talking about reminds me of a certain verse.
It's not on.
In the Bhagavad Gita.
It's not on.
I think it's 1841, where it says, Krishna's controlling the wanderings of all the living entities, as if they're on a machine made of a material energy, and that nothing you're doing is by chance. Nothing. And it's as you say, it's just realizing that He's put me in this position. He's in control.
Mm.
Don't worry.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Bhagavad Gita 1861, I think that was. Sorry, 1841, yeah. Sarvabhutani yantarurudhani mayaya. I thought it was 61. It's okay. Thank you. Thank you, Purushan Prabhu. We're instruments in the hands of the Lord. Any other comments, questions?
Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you so much for your class. I just had one very short question. You repeated that as we are engaged in devotional service, at some point or other we are forced to surrender. I was wondering if you could expand on that. In what way are we forced? Because the word force is kind of strong. And
thank you for bringing that up. It's an interesting point. Somebody who's very linguistic will pick up that I use the word forced. So this idea of forced, when we use it in a modern context, it almost feels like it's something we don't want to do. It feels like somebody's forcing something on me. Very negative feeling, right? When somebody forces us to do something. But actually, this idea of being forced to surrender is something that we internally do. Because if I go back to the sort of the growth in our service I explained, where initially we're just engaging in service. Somebody's given us a task to do in service, we just do it. Whatever happens, happens. You know, it's their responsibility. Whether it's done well, whether it's not done well, it's their responsibility. We just ask to do it. But then as we expand, when we are internally developing that mood of surrender, that internal mood of, I want to do this for Krishna, we take on that responsibility. But then there comes a tipping point where we take a responsibility that is beyond what we're able to do based on our material situation. And then we're forced to think and contemplate, I've taken this on. I've taken this responsibility on. How am I going to do it? How am I actually going to achieve what I've said I'll do in my service? And that's when we rely on Krishna, on Guru, to go, I can't do anything. I'm just a dumb man. I'm just a lame man. I'm coming to you, Guru, Gauranga, Krishna, the Vaishnavas, because I realize that it's only by your mercy, by your empowerment, by your Kripa Shakti, by the parampara of mercy that empowers one, that actually, if I don't turn to you guys, if I don't turn to the process of surrender, I'm not going to be able to achieve the service and fulfill the responsibilities I've set out to achieve. So this idea of forced is because we've come to a point where our internal consciousness is about, I want to do everything in my capacity and beyond for Krishna, and we take something on which our normal everyday life can't handle. Like if I take, for example, apologies for using this Panchatattva Prabhu, but Panchatattva Prabhu is a great musician, right? Now, if he was to play a harmonium, then great, you know, like it's like, I know how to play a harmonium, I'll play the tunes that I normally play. But then imagine if he was tasked to play an instrument that he's never played before. It'd be like, I can't do that, I'm not going to play. I mean, I don't know about Panchatattva Prabhu, but at least I'll be like that. I'm like, I won't play. I didn't play any instruments today because I didn't feel comfortable. I myself didn't take to the process of surrender in playing instruments. But of course, there's the aspect of pleasing the Vaishnava as well, so I didn't want to play an instrument and play it really badly that the Vaishnavas aren't pleased by it, you know. But yeah, I don't know if that helps. This idea that actually it's the internal consciousness, this internal desire to serve in a capacity that is beyond the limitations of our material situation. And when we take that responsibility on, we're forced to surrender because our desire is to fulfill the service, but it's not in our capacity to do so. I don't know if that helps, but okay. Any other questions, comments? So how is a materialist empowered to do amazing things in the world? But I'm going to rephrase that as saying amazing, temporary and material amazing things. And that's what we have to bear in mind. There is this aspect of previous karma that they come with, right? Where they're materially meant to become successful, right? That's one way to understand it, that the material they're meant to become successful. Big, but it's temporary. And so we see it day in, day out. This celebrity committed suicide. They were so successful, but that success meant nothing to them. This business tycoon lost everything just by one bad decision in their business. So yeah, they achieve amazing material things. Could we say they're empowered? Well, maybe you could argue that they're empowered by Maya Devi because their desire is to engage in Maya, in the service of the senses. But is that really empowerment? Would we really want to use the word empowerment with that? Because when we use the word empowerment, at least me, I'll use it in the context that we're actually achieving something which is lasting, which is for everybody, and something which is actually going to bring eternal benefit to me and to others. When I think of the word empowerment, that's what comes for me. So, would I feel comfortable using the word empowered for those materialists? I don't think so. Karmically, very, very well off, yes. But, I mean, five topics of the Gita, and karma is the only one that isn't eternal. So, yeah. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Srimad Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Shri Prabhupada Ki.